Thank you, everybody. Nice to be with you, at least in this form. So one thing that I've been thinking about and stumbled upon lately is, well, some of you probably know, me and my wife also have a nonprofit organization called the Secular Dharma Foundation. And I've been very interested in secular aspects of Dharma. And what I mean by that simply is actually just kind of what is a non-monastic Dharma practice look like? And when I say non-monastic, I certainly don't mean anti-monastic at all. I'm just not a monastic person. I don't have any aspiration to be. So when I come into these other teachings, looking at a monastic tradition, it's no surprise that I don't find a lot there. So when you look at the early teachings, it's pretty clear, actually, at the time of the Buddha, there were really two paths of practice. There was the path of practice that most of us are familiar with, which was the monastic tradition, which was you renounce the world, you take the bowl, you take on the robe, you shave your head, you join the monastery, which I think it's, we wouldn't be here if it wasn't for that. And you take on 227 precepts and you really dedicate yourself to this practice moment to moment. No family, no children, no household, no finances, none of the stuff that most of us deal with every day. But at the time of the Buddha, I believe there was also another path of practice for people who were non-monastics, people who were farmers or woodworkers or blacksmiths, or at the time of the Buddha, there was enough of wealth that people started to do things like that. There were people who made different potters and clay workers and builders and all kinds of different things. What they would be called as artisans, people who had a craft and had a way of making a life for themselves in the world. And there was a lot of those people, actually, quite a lot of those people who practiced the Dharma, who practiced the Buddhist teachings and really embodied it in a very practical way and were very serious about it. It wasn't very long after the Buddha died, and it might even been before he died, where that kind of fell by the wayside. And it sort of has emerged, you know, some 2,500 years later in contemporary American culture, where people are actually interested enough in the Dharma to say, yeah, I want to do this. I'm interested in this. And many people come through the world of mindfulness or MBSR, or however you read a book, you hear a podcast. I mean, it's so easy to come into contact with this stuff nowadays. And then the question becomes, well, how do we actually, if we're serious about this, how do we actually do it? And the way to understand the aspect of that is a word that makes a lot of sense, which what the practice was about, was this desire to be free, this desire to be liberated is the word that they use in the Buddhist language. This word vimutti, which means liberation. And much of the Dharma practice is to liberate ourselves. And then the question becomes, well, what am I trying to liberate myself from? Because sometimes the word means deliverance or emancipation or release. What is it that I'm trying to release myself from? And what am I releasing myself to? So it's kind of looking at the two sides of the coin of freedom. There's freedom from something and there's freedom to something. Now, unfortunately, most of us, when we think of Buddhism, we think about what we're trying to do is to free ourselves from suffering, which is, I think, tricky business. Because when the Buddha speaks of the word liberation of vimutti, he's always talking about liberating ourselves from the forces of greed, hatred, and confusion. That's really what we're trying to liberate ourselves from. And to live in a mind that is non-reactive, that is non-conditioned, that is not predetermined by me getting the things that I want and me trying to avoid the things that I don't want and all of the confusion that comes when I'm unable to do that, which is kind of most people's recipe for life. Most people in our culture think that happiness is acquired through getting what you want and avoiding what you don't want. And if you could like pull that off, then you'd be happy. You're probably familiar with this strategy. And the Buddha saying, absolutely not. And it's not so much that causes suffering, but it actually blocks us. It hinders us from a deeper sense of ease or a deeper sense of meaning, or really it blocks us from becoming the people that we would like to be. And a lot of times what blocks us from becoming the people that we like to be is when we start kind of betraying our sense of values or our sense of integrity for material gain, for status, for a whole bunch of different things. And when we do that, we don't really feel good about ourselves, do we? I know I don't. So we're looking for this kind of vimutti liberation that's actually much more of a chitta vimutti, as a liberating the mind and liberating the heart from this kind of contamination, from this kind of tendency to believing that I need to get what I want and need to avoid what I don't want, which is really kind of the more of the non-monastic path or the contemporary path, or really us. Whereas the monastic tradition is much more, there's two ways to think about liberation. There's chitta vimutti and panya vimutti, which is liberation through wisdom, which is largely what the monastic work is, which is where you don't deal with sexuality, you don't deal with money, you don't deal with a lot of the difficult stuff that we deal with, because you want to give yourself these really great conditions where you can practice, you know, meditation 10, 15, 18 hours a day and dedicate your life to that, which I think is beautiful. And I'm grateful that people have done that. But I'm not going to do that. And so I have to have a practice that's going to address the demands of my life, the limitations of my life. I mean, if I'm lucky, if I sit 4 or 5 days a week for 30 or 45 minutes, that's like really pretty good for me, you know? You know, and most monks do that on a Monday before noon, you know, like they've already done that. So I'm having to have a more broader perspective on what liberation means for me. And I think that when I engage the world every day like I do, the posture that I bring to the world, the initial posture that I bring to the world is through the words that I say to the world. But I mean, I talk to people every day, but really I'm talking to the world. I'm telling the world how I feel. I'm telling the world how it's not living up to my expectations. And I have to some degree, a slightly dysfunctional relationship to the world, because I don't agree with a lot of the things that I see in the world. And a lot of the ways I'm going to create positive change in the world and to deal with that conflict and that disagreement is going to come through the words that I choose to use. And being blaming and finger pointing and contemptuous and defensive and self-righteous are not going to be very helpful, actually, turns out. You know, I'll tell you this story. I have a very interesting, I take on these kind of unique Dharma projects, right? I find myself in these conditions that are very unfavorable and difficult. I say, oh, wow, this is a great opportunity for practice. And I have small children. And one of the things that happens when you have small children is your children become friends with other kids. And then at some point you meet those kids' parents. And there's always that fear and that anxiety that your child made friends with somebody whose parents are gonna like totally not gonna be on the same level as me, right? So I have to have this stealth Dharma posture because I live in rural Colorado. And my son Emma has a friend whose dad is a retired Navy SEAL, who was like high up covert operations in Iraq and Benghazi. And like, there's movies, Hollywood movies made about like friends of his, like he's that level of military. Like the dude looks like G.I. Joe when you see him and he tells you he's a Navy SEAL. You're like, obviously, dude, you're a Navy SEAL. Like you look like G.I. Joe. And he's a really nice guy, and his kid and my kid are really good friends, and I love my son and he loves his son, and there's a lot of stuff that him and I do not probably see eye to eye on, like a lot of stuff. And so when I'm talking to this person, am I going to be the self-righteous Buddhist with all the answers, or am I just going to be in this kind of relational, how can I be authentic to my voice, how can I be true to myself but not create divisiveness, or to not create blaming, or not to create my view is the righter view and your view is the lesser view and you need to see things my way. In fact, if you saw things my way, the world wouldn't be the fucking mess that it's in. Which is really, really, so, you know, sometimes, and I hang out with this guy once in a while. I went to his house for barbecue a few weeks ago. I talked to him for 2 or 3 hours. It was so hard. It was the hardest Dharma practice I've ever had to do. Because I actually like this guy. He's like a cool guy. He's very interesting. But there's a lot of, you know, having to kind of Jedi mind trick my way around some, like, you know, a largely stuff with politics and, you know, things like that. And I got back in the car with my wife and we were driving home and she was like, how was that? I was like, man, that was hard. Like, that was really fun and really hard. And she's like, I think he really wanted you to like him. And I was like, what? I was like, I didn't pick up on that at all, man. Like, I didn't pick up that at all. She's like, well, think about it. He lives out here. He doesn't know anybody. He meets you. You're kind of like, you know, this kind of high energy tattooed guy. Like, he doesn't have a lot of friends. And she's like, I think he wanted you to like him. And I didn't pick up on that at all the whole time. And so it's interesting how I didn't read those dynamics. They're like, oh, this person is trying to connect with me, you know, and I'm trying to connect with him. And we're trying to have this human connection and trying to find some common ground without letting the kind of details of politics and this and that and vaccine and no vaccine and whatever, whatever, get in the way of that. And I'll tell you what, man, that is hard. And so if I'm going to be serious about my practice, which I like to think that I am, it's not about being right. It's not about seeing things better or being more clear. It's about being skillful. So, of course, my Dharma project here is like, I want to get this guy to come sit a retreat. You know, that would be like a dream come true, you know, like to like turn him onto the Dharma. And we had like conversations about that because he asked me what I did. And, you know, I kind of dodge it. Like, oh, I work in mental health and I, you know, teach emotional intelligence and this practice called mindfulness. He's like, oh, that's really cool. You know, but it's like trying to stay in the conversation. And I think a lot of times when it comes to these difficult situations, there's a Jewish rabbi that I did a lot of work with in Nashville, Tennessee, named Rami Shapiro. And if you've never heard of Rami Shapiro, you should check him out. He's a really cool dude. And his whole thing on spirituality is whether you're talking about Buddhism or Judaism or whatever you're talking about, he's like, the goal is to keep the conversation going. You know, I feel the same way about Dharma practice. It's like, because as soon as I'm right and you're wrong, the conversation is over. And that's very destructive. Right? And it's like, I can't actually hear another word this person has to say. Like, very, very destructive, shutting down the conversation. And you know what shuts down the conversation quicker than anything else? Is I'm right and you're wrong. I have the right view because I'm a Buddhist, because I practice right view. You have the wrong view because you're whatever you are. And now I'm contemptuous, and now I've kind of taken this moral superior high ground to the other person, and I've completely missed the whole point of this practice in doing so. And imagine if people were better at this. Now it's like all of a sudden this whole practice of right speech becomes very exciting, doesn't it? You're like, wow, I never thought of it that way. And so when we look at the traditional map, I guess, the teaching on speech or right view, I'm just going to say right speech because that's mostly how you guys know it, but I really think it's about finding our voice. And it's really finding an authentic voice, actually, I think is the practice. As we, you know, the general thing is to try to be true, to try to be truthful, right? To try to be honest. But not like honesty is good and lying is bad and honesty is right and dishonesty is wrong. Because actually, to be honest with you, in the exchange with my friend, my neighbor's your friend, I had to actually be a little dishonest at moments. You know, he might have asked me what I thought about certain political things. Or, and I wouldn't say that I lied, but I didn't totally tell him exactly how I felt. I didn't say the truth for me because it wasn't actually skillful in that moment. It would have been divisive. It probably would have shut the conversation down. And then I had mixed feelings about that. I had to deal with my own, like, oh, I'm not being truthful here. I'm actually, so you see, it's not that black and white, is it? Right? But to be truthful is good, right? There's no doubt about that, but it's not something that we just want to just switch that on. Like, because sometimes being honest can be really hurtful. Right? It's not always skillful, but it's a good idea. It's a mindfulness practice. It's something to bear in mind. We want to bear in mind often when we're talking and trying to be honest and truthful, but it's not an absolute. If there's one thing the Buddha does not teach, it's absolutes. And the other one is and what am I saying? Is it useful right now? Is it helpful? Is it keeping the conversation going? Is it constructive? Is it adaptive? Is it working? And sometimes in moments I find myself, well, what I'm saying isn't exactly true right now, but it's really useful, right? And so then it becomes, well, which one is it? It's like, well, we have to be more sophisticated. We have to understand that finding our voice and being in the voice of others is a very complicated dance where we just can't apply like the list of the four gates as some kind of absolute way to be. Is this useful? Is what I'm saying useful? Is it kind? The third gate. Is it kind? Is it friendly? Is it increasing a sense of friendliness between me and the person right in front of me right now? Metta, the voice of metta, the voice of kindness, the voice of cooperation, the voice of acceptance, the voice of I can see your humanity. I value you as a person, even though I don't agree with what you're saying right now. Whew, that's hard, man. That is some advanced practice right now. You know, back when I used to travel at airports, I used to notice like if you miss your flight, you ever miss your flight, and then there's the long line of people going to the airline to try to get their flight fixed. And if you ever notice, most people are not particularly kind to the woman behind the counter who's trying to get you a hotel or a flight. Very blaming, and you know, it's like the lady knows, the person behind the counter knows that you're inconvenienced and you need to get on a new flight. But I always notice in those situations that I'd always be kind, you know. And also really hard to be kind with people that we don't agree with. I don't have to like you and I don't have to agree with you to be kind, to speak the voice. So what is the voice of kindness? And do you know when you're in it? And do you know when you're not in it? Do you know when you're in the voice of like, this isn't a friendly way of communication. This isn't metta. This is kind of blaming. This is kind of defensive. This is kind of finger wagging. And if you start to watch, you'll notice that. I know what my finger wagging voice feels and sounds like. It doesn't feel good. It feels right. Often it feels very right. But it doesn't feel good. And then it really doesn't feel good later. That's the one thing I've noticed about it the worst. You ever walk away from a conversation, think to yourself, oh my God, I can't believe I said that. What was I thinking? Well, I wasn't mindful. A lot of it too, this is a mindfulness practice. I wasn't bearing this in mind when I was having this conversation because I was too reactive. I wasn't liberated. I was all worked up and I was reactive and I wasn't speaking my voice. I was speaking society's voice. I was speaking, I turned into my dad for a minute. I turned into some other character of my conditioning. I wasn't embodied in that sense of voice. The other one that's really tricky, I think, is timeliness. Is now the right time to say this? Like when you're angry with somebody, you probably shouldn't talk to them about what you're angry about with them whilst you're angry with them. I don't know if you've noticed this. This one never pans out for me. Like if I'm angry with somebody, I usually have to wait till I'm not angry anymore to go back into. So I sometimes have to know, like, I really want to duke this out right now, but now is not the time for me to have this conversation. And so even those four, is trying to be true, trying to be useful, trying to be kind, trying to be timely. That's more or less all you're going to find in the teachings of right speech. And they're pretty good, but there's really kind of, I think, a lot more. And the last one that I like to add is authenticity. Am I being authentic? Am I saying what feels, for lack of a better word, true to me? Am I coming from my own sense of integrity, my own sense of sila? Because sometimes I might be hitting all four. What I'm saying is true, it's useful, it's kind, it's timely, but it's not authentic. It's not me. I'm not saying something that I would normally say. And I think that Buddhist communities kind of get into this trap where we kind of adopt this kind of good Buddhist kind of dialogue where we talk a certain way, or we it tends to be kind of conflict avoidant, or it tends to be kind of inauthentic sometimes. And it's also, I think, important to practice this stuff, because I'm sure you can all think of people in your life. I bet you all those people in your life that when you're around those people, you can talk how you can totally talk authentic. You can totally speak your heart. You can speak your voice. You don't have to add all these little filters in, right? And of course, you'll probably notice that those are the people you enjoy talking to the most, because you can just be you, right? And so that, so that's also what we call Kalyana Mita. You know, this word Kalyana Mita, spiritual friend, Dharma friend, good friend. Interestingly enough, Kalyana means something like more like good. Mita is actually the root of metta. Good friend, friendliness, metta. In Sanskrit, the word is mitra. It's all that same thing. So a good friend is somebody that you can be friendly with, that you can talk to, that you can openly communicate, you can share your heart without feeling the fear of being judged, without the fear of being needing to be perceived in a certain way, maybe even being able to say some things that in other contexts would probably be pretty unskillful. I think we call it venting or something like that, where you just kind of gotta, I think we need to have those people in our lives where we can just kind of hang out with and kind of unload. I call it the Duke of Download. Sometimes when I talk to some of my Dharma teacher friends or other people, I'm like, can I just take 5 minutes and just unload some dukkha on you right now, that I need to just put voice to this, because it's really true for me right now. It's in my heart and it's stressing me out, and I don't like it, and I have mixed feelings about it, and I don't feel liberated about it. And so a lot of times I'm like, yeah, have at it. And I can do that, and that feels more authentic to me. Maybe some of the things I say aren't particularly kind, maybe there's some blaming, maybe there's some other peopling going on, but I think we need to be able to do that. In emotional science, there's a word they use for that called co-regulation, where a lot of times when we're having these authentic conversations with people that we trust, that are friends with us, we co-regulate each other's emotion. So being able to kind of be authentic in my experience, and me not being judged in that space, between the two of us, we're co-regulating back and forth. We're kind of regulating each other's anger, our contempt, our fear, our sadness, whatever it is. And it's really important that we kind of need, from the view of science, we kind of need to do that. Of course, sometimes we have to pay $250 an hour to go do that with a trained professional, which I have done and I do. And I think there's a lot of value in that, but I think there's also a lot of value in finding places where we can do that. And sometimes we don't necessarily always feel so comfortable doing that in Dharma communities or in certain spiritual communities, because it's like, you know, it's not right speech or something. You know, and then we find that we have to kind of be a little bit inauthentic in certain spaces, because we're like, this is why I like the 12-step world is such a great world. If people, you can go to an AA meeting and more or less say anything and nobody's really going to give you a hard time, you know. So there's that kind of co-regulation piece, which is really good and I think healthy for people to get. And so in so doing this, we're kind of cultivating our own voice, and we're also transforming the kind of dishonest aspects of ourselves, or trying to force ourselves into a box that we know we kind of don't fit in, which I've done before. And so trying to see this or take this on as actually a practice, a sila practice, you being actually true to your own self. And again, a lot of it has to do with, I'm glad Sandy brought it up, is transforming the internal narrative that you have. Do you all have an internal narrative? I have an internal narrative. It's like, I don't watch sports anymore, but if you ever watch sports, there's a guy who comments on every single play. In fact, I think there's usually a couple of those guys. Like I have those guys, remember those guys in the Muppet Show, the guys up in the balcony who just kind of like trashed on everybody. I feel like those guys are in my mind all the time, just telling me how I'm not doing it right. and how I should have done this and how I shouldn't have done that. And I did that again. And why did I do that again? Right. And a lot of that is my own internal voice. It's my own kind of internal narrator. I always love those movies where the narrator's like, I think of the movie like Stand By Me, where like, the, you know, those movies where there's like a movie and then somebody narrates the whole movie. I'm always like, I wish I had like Richard Dreyfuss or somebody narrating my, not Samuel L. Jackson and like the bad scenes of Pulp Fiction, like yelling at me for doing it wrong, but a kind of a more kind, a more friendly narrator. And, you know, and the last thing I'll say is this, because I want to hear some questions and have some dialogue about this is, you know, 25 years ago or so, I was at the Insight Meditation Society, sitting a retreat, as I did in the early 90s and my early 20s. And it was like 10-day retreat. And I was going to, as I usually was going to do, about day six or seven, I'm usually ready to leave. Sort of had enough. And it was, there was a lot of emphasis on metta practice during this one particular retreat. And I just really couldn't take it. Mostly I couldn't take it because my internal narrative was so unkind that to try to do metta with that narrative at the same time was so polarizing, I just couldn't take it. And I went to my teacher, I said, yeah, I think I'm gonna go. I said, I don't think this is for me, you know? So I really don't get this metta practice. I don't see why we're doing this. It doesn't make sense. It's just making me feel bad, actually. And he said, is your mind a friendly companion? And I was like, what? He's like, is your mind a friendly companion? I was like, no. I was like, is that a thing? Do people have that? And he said, you need to do this practice until your mind is a friendly companion, until your mind actually has your back. And there's a cooperative, now there's a dialogue. Now I used to argue with my mind, but now we mostly just have these kind of really ironic, hilarious conversations much of the time. And so I think one of the, and this isn't highlighted very much in the practice, maybe it's implicitly noted, but one of the great benefits of having a Dharma practice is the transformative experience you have with your own moment-to-moment narrative. And if that's all you get out of it, like, isn't that awesome? That your actually mind becomes a benevolent and friendly, like, companion who's like, rooting you on. So like, yeah, you kind of dropped the ball over there, but it's okay, man. People make mistakes, like that kind of, the way that you would talk to your best friend. Or the way that your best friend would talk to you. And I think it's really important that we can kind of begin to understand that everything I'm talking about is an aspect of right speech. And I notice that for me, when I have this broader perspective on it, I'm much actually more excited. I'm much more interested. I'm understanding this teaching in a much more dynamic way. And I can actually see the progress. And so we'll talk about this more next Thursday. I'll get into right action, which we'll look at in a much different way as we have with this. And then right livelihood, and really seeing how these three can be kind of seen in a broader sense in a contemporary society where we can really see them as practices that we can bring to much more moments of our life in a way. And really, I think that probably realizing that these are the practices that you find yourself struggling with the most. What to say, what to do, how to live, how to make money, how to not make money, how to navigate contemporary society, which is largely done through talking, acting, and working. And if you don't see that as part of a practice or part of a Dharma practice, it can be really frustrating. So that's what I have for you this evening. Thank you very much for your kind attention, and I would be very interested to hear what thoughts, questions, or concerns you might have about looking at this path factor from a different perspective.